Thank you for listening to another episode of WNIJ's Poetically Yours Extended Podcast. I'm Yvonne Booz. This podcast is an extension of the weekly segment. This month, we feature dancer, choreographer, and educator Alexandra Beller. Now, I know you may be thinking, how does choreography and poetry intertwine? Well, Alexandra explains the connection beautifully during this conversation. Take a listen.
All right, Alexandra, thank you for joining me for the Poetically Yours podcast. Before we talk about your book, The Anatomy of Art, Unlocking the Creative Process for Theater and Dance, I want to talk about your journey as a poet, as a dancer, and also the work you've done in theater.
Great. I feel like my journey has been from dance to choreography to theater to teaching to healing work. It's been a pretty fluid journey, and writing has been a part of that since I was a kid. I did have a period where poetry itself as a genre was really my my driver. And since then, I feel like I have like a poetic sensibility to my writing, but I'm often writing more in prose and about somatics and more conceptual material about creative process. But I feel like writing has always been a place where I have found expression and flow.
Now, I know that you've talked about, in some of the things that I've read, that you've worked with poets. Can you tell me about that experience and how you've helped them unclog, I should say?
I've had quite a few poets who've been through embodiment processes with me, where we're working on finding authenticity and feeling how the lived dynamics and embodied dynamics can become art. So I think of art as a condensing and saturating of our lived experience toward a heightened gesture. And that gesture can be physical, verbal, visual, written. To me, the modality is in some ways arbitrary. Like, I think a poetic gesture can be an embodied gesture. It can be a statement that we say or write. It can be a visual gesture, a stroke, a color. What is meaningful to me is finding that authenticity from the body and allowing that to become a saturated, concentrated gesture of lived experience that becomes meaningful to the receiver. And so I think getting poets into their bodies is critical. And I do think it's a place where we can sometimes forget that we have a body and how useful that body can be in feeling ourselves and what we're trying to say and what's critical and fundamental to us. And I do think that getting poets back into embodiment allows them to find their voice and their power and their flow, especially if they might have lost it. One way that I've worked with poets has been to support them in their own poetry. But then I did this project that was really delightful, in which a poet was a featured role. And we went through this process. So I choreographed something. I created set movement material. I taught it to a class, and I recorded myself describing the movement. So often when we're teaching movement, we come up with these sometimes poetic, sometimes silly, sometimes really functional ways of describing movement. You know, this slashes, slices, this pours, sometimes it's a sound effect. So I recorded how I described this phrase, and then I wrote down that description. And it, you know, didn't mean anything in terms of like your right leg crosses your left leg, and you know, it was like a your head drops slowly like a helium balloon, catch down a mountain, body of water, slice underneath, whoobang. So that was like the kind of description that I did for this phrase, and I wrote it down on a piece of paper. I gave it to my dancers who were in my company, and I had them each choreograph what they felt like I was describing. And then the rest, the company would look at what they had choreographed, and we re-described it, but bringing in popular culture and song lyrics and things like that. Then I gave that little song that we made up about their dance to a different dancer, and I had them choreograph like a sign language sized phrase. And then I brought in a sign language interpreter, and I asked her if there were any real ASL signs and what they were doing. And it turned out there were so many. And so I had her translate into ASL what she saw these gestures doing. And I took that as a word bank. So the sign language interpreter was like, two snakes under a fence, down a, et cetera. And I gave that word bank to a poet, Emily Skillings, who's a lovely poet and a friend of mine. And I asked her in real time, so I gave her essentially like 10 minutes to compose a poem using only the words from that word bank. And while that was happening, something else was happening on stage. And so we watched the word bank get invented, and we watched her receive it. And then she is sitting at a old typewriter, and she had 10 minutes to write a poem from this word bank. And then in real time, she would get to a microphone and give us this poem. And we, in the meantime, had created movement material from the same word bank. And then we danced what we made to her poem.
Oh, that is amazing. And totally different. I hadn't heard of anything like that. And I can tell you, when I first saw the book, I was reading the title and I said, oh, The Anatomy of Art, Unlocking the Creative Process for Theater and Dance. And then I was like, wait a minute, I have to go back to your email because I know you explained how it all relates to poetry. Now, as I was reading it, I could tell, and even as a poet myself, I can see how the things you were saying in the book can really help with getting that stuff that's sitting inside of you out. So one of the things that I noted that you talked about, binary thinking and the problem with opposites, which I had a poet who was saying that life is about opposites, the cold and the hot, but your approach is a little different. Can you tell me, why does thinking outside of this concept open up so many possibilities for writers?
I think that we get conditioned into binary thinking. And what I mean by binary thinking is things are yes or no, they're good or bad, they're, you know, cold or hot, as you said, it's humor or it's pathos. But I think we know from some of the art we love the most that often there's complexity and contradiction. And that actually is more familiar to the lived experience in which we are grieving and then our toddler does something ridiculous and we start laughing. And inside our laughter, we can still feel the grief, but there's also joy. Or, you know, even at the funeral for the person we're grieving, something ridiculous happens and there's a moment of lightness or like satire, which is often humor about something that's painful. So I think that lived experience is full of contradiction, and the tensegrity between things is really where we live. And yet a lot of the systems that contain and try to control us, including white supremacy and capitalism and patriarchy, they try to reduce things and reduce stories and reduce us to types. And, oh, you're the type who this, or women do that, or, you know, poor people do this. And that kind of coding and bias and cliche stereotype reduces us, I think, in order to control us. And I think in a rejection of the binary, and of course, you know, we're discovering this around gender and sexuality and all these kind of things. Oh, everything's a spectrum. Everything's a continuum. Where am I at this moment in this situation on the continuum of consent or pleasure? And I think the lived experience is so nuanced and so shaded, and poetic sensibility and poetic expression wants to have every choice available. Every word is available. We're not following structures and strictures around grammar that are in prose, expectations that are part of prose, right? We are able to reject a lot of those rules. And in rejecting those rules, I think we want to leave everything available on the table. I might use every possible word here. But for every possible word to be on the table, I think we do need to reject binary thinking, because that often puts only two words on the table.
I got it. And I love when you said, what if instead of asking whether something is good or better, we asked what attracts, repels, delights, or disturbs us? Why is that so important?
Well, I think often the good or bad is based on conditioning. And that's often somebody else's good or bad. You know, you should look this way. You should write this way. The audience should feel this way, et cetera. And it diminishes our voice and our intuition and our instinct. And of course, those are so critical to artistic expression, whatever the medium. And I think attached to good and bad is also like, well, my favorite writer writes like this, or my favorite artist does this, or the audience feels this with this kind of work. And even in terms of genre, like artistic genre, you know, you're talking about, oh, well, your book says these words, dance and theater, in the title, so maybe I assumed it wouldn't be applicable to writers or poets. And then I'm reading it and realizing, actually, it does. And it's because there's so much more that actually connects us than divides us. And we get so focused on the division. And of course, we're in a moment like this in this country and in so many ideologies where we focus on the division rather than focusing on how things are similar. And different forms of lived experience can unite us. And I do think that poetry is often trying to find the strata where lived experiences find simultaneity or cohesion, that like you can say something in a certain way in which so many different people with different lived experiences can have a, oh, I know that feeling, or, oh, that lands. And you want to be able to have that with people with wildly different identities. So there's something about like what is your body saying in this moment? Where's your intuition drawing you? Where's your authenticity speaking that helps you find that word or turn of phrase that can be so personal that it becomes universal? So there's a book called The Shape of Content by the author Ben Shahn, and there's a chapter in it called Biography of a Painting. And in it, he says, essentially, I'm paraphrasing, but he says, artists often are trying to please the biggest audience possible. And in trying to include more and more people, they get more and more generic. And suddenly their work is trying to be universal and actually speaks to nobody because it's really just a cliche or an empty vessel. And actually, the more specific and more personal we get, and the more we're making something that feels like, I think this is only just me, this is so true for me, actually, the more people will recognize it.
You do write poetry. And so if I'm putting you on the spot, that's okay. I could take this part out. But if you have something you would like to share with our listeners, that would be delightful.
Something I've written?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. You know what? I feel like I could read a little snippet from the conclusion of my book. It's not a poem, but I do feel like there's something in it that is a manifesto.
That feels okay. When I was reading certain parts and I did not get through the whole thing yet, I saw poetry in it. For example, you wrote something, you said, these moments show how mortality and attention are braided. And I was like, oh, that is wonderful. Using that verb braided.
All right. I'm going to read a couple. I'm going to sort of like in real time create a little bit of poetry out of my conclusion. So here's what I know.
Okay.
A book of questions implies that there will be answers. But as we close this, I'm reminded that the best art rarely provides answers. It moves us to ask more. Making is not tidying things up, but unfolding them, diving into the mess of life and creating something from it. Nonetheless, as we close this book, I will offer some of the answers I've culled through my art making and vigorous living. Say yes. Say no. Say maybe not right now. Give me a minute to think about it. Give yourself a break. Work harder. Answer with your body. Be critical and well-researched. Ride your intuition. Be strict and restrain yourself. Let yourself ramble. Interrupt yourself. Make a safe space. Let yourself be truly uncomfortable. Forgive yourself. Demand something of yourself. See a ton of art, hibernate, and get reclusive. Make something fast. Take your time. Laugh at yourself. Recognize the importance of what you're doing. These statements contradict each other. That's the point. Art is not about absolutes, but balance, negotiation, and risk. It's about living inside the paradox of discipline and freedom, instinct and analysis, rigor and play. Art asks for your attention, openness, playfulness, to question your assumptions and push past your habits, to fail and keep going, to trust the road with no idea where you're headed, to risk failure and mediocrity, brilliance and misunderstanding, to offer yourself without knowing how you'll be received. And this is the paradox. Art asks us to be vulnerable and resilient. To be changed by what we make. Looking into the mirror of our creations, we face the unknown in ourselves. We ask something bigger to pass through us without consuming us. Art gives us the freedom to imagine new worlds, rewrite the rules, and inhabit the impossible, to say what can't be said, make the hidden visible, and hold complexity without resolution. Art connects us, reminds us we're not alone, that every facet of our reality is shared with something. It's an act of empathy flowing on a two-way road. Art doesn't tie things up neatly. It expands the terrain of what's possible. It's a labyrinth, a storm, and a question that leads to more questions. But this is the gift. Art changes us every time we make it. Let this be your permission slip. Your lantern, your dare. This book will wait for you on the shelf. Come back when you're tangled, lost, empty, or overflowing. But now go, break something. Ask again. Begin anyway. Don't just make art, be made by it. And if your heart is pounding a little, good. That's your cue.
Well, that is amazing. And I see poetry all through that book. And one thing that caught my attention, I know as a poet, sometimes I feel a little bad when I'm not writing. Like, oh my goodness, I have lines coming through and I'll write them down or I'll put it in the voice memo. But still, it's nagging at me that I haven't birthed this. But one thing that you said, it makes me think a little deeper. And I hope our listeners who are writers and poets, I hope they look at it this way as well. And I feel like this book is going to give people the opportunity to really dig deep when they're creating. So you said we blame ourselves for not creating, but it's really a flaw of character. More often, something in the ecosystem is misaligned. If your current project had a voice, what would it ask for? That last line, what would it ask for? It makes me think about, oh my goodness, I'm like, if I'm working on a book, what does this book, like using personification, need? What's the voice of the book? And I think that's going to help me really reach deeper and write to give a better product. What inspired you to really dig deep and give all this great advice? Like, how long have these things been twirling around in your mind before you decided, let me put this out in the book, because I know other artists, whether they're writer, actors, singers, are going through something similar.
Well, I love artists. I think it's such a brave thing to do, to put your deep self, your true self out there. I think transparency, honesty, authenticity, vulnerability, those are such beautiful traits of humans and not always the most common. And to really dedicate some part of yourself or even your whole professional life to it, it takes a lot of guts. And I really love artists of all mediums, and I feel honored to have been able to be a support or a mentor for them over the years. And I found myself in giving feedback, and I think feedback can be a pretty fraught thing, and it can sometimes be violent, and I've always been interested in finding a way to make feedback that is both rigorous, challenging, and also loving and generous and inclusive. And I think sometimes that's another binary thinking that comes up, where it's like either your feedback is, oh, we might call it sugar-coated, like, oh, just tell me what you liked, or just tell me these very objective, neutral things you saw, or rip me to shreds based on your opinion and your desires and your proclivities. And I don't think either one of them is really useful. So I've always wanted to be able to be a tension and a challenge and an obstacle for artists in a way that was like loving them and supporting them and being with them, not trying to coerce or control them to make art that I liked, but to really help them map themselves and find their art, their voice, and stand behind, and help them stand behind it. Whether I liked their art or not is irrelevant to me. So I often worked with Liz Lerman's method of feedback, which is called critical response process. And this is a great process also for responding to writing, CRP, critical response process. And a major tenet of that is that it's artist-centered. And so often the artist will ask the feedbackers first questions, like frame what you want us to talk about. What are you curious about? Where have you hit a wall? What are your questions about your work? Those are the first questions that get asked. And then after that, the feedbacker asks what we call neutral questions. And by neutral, it means there's not an opinion embedded in it. Like, why was that so long? Or why did you choose that part, which I didn't like, you know? So it's really like, I'm really curious about your choice around duration there. And the trick is not just to frame your question as if you're curious, but to actually get curious. And so the work for the person giving feedback is to let go of opinion and actually say, yeah, I hated how long that was. That's not the relevant part right now. What's relevant is I am curious about what you wanted from that, because in my body, I didn't like how long that was. So I'm curious what you were trying to get. But I'm not saying all that to the choreographer, the artist. I am actually trying to get myself truly curious. So I found myself in rooms doing a lot of work to ask a great question that was not coercive, and a question that would help the artist look inward without any shame, but with rigor, and really look for an answer. And I often felt like, oh, the room just changed. When I asked that question, people sat up differently and the breath was different and somebody's eyes lit up. And I was like, oh, these are good questions. And I was like, oh, I think I have some skill around crafting a question that acts as a scalpel to get through layers of something to get to the center of something. So I started writing down my questions. This was about a decade ago. And I was accumulating all these questions over time. Meanwhile, I was writing lots of other stuff, thoughts and statements. And then I was like, oh, I'm going to write a book of questions. And then it felt a little too easy to just write questions, and it felt in some ways like I was hiding. And so then I wanted to put myself more out on the line, because that's what I'm asking artists to do, to be brave and vulnerable. And I felt like if I didn't make statements, I wasn't modeling that. So then I started writing about these topics, about I made these 12 categories for the questions. It's time, space, meaning, relationship, environment, process, facts, faith, communication, material, context, and culture, and priorities. Those are my 12 topics. Each one of those is a chapter. And that was how I started to organize these questions, questions about time, questions about space. And I was like, all right, write an essay about time, write an essay about space. So I wrote essays about all of these. And then I started to write embodiment prompts and writing prompts and scores. And, you know, each chapter just started to flesh out a little. So now each chapter has a journey, an arc. And there are these 12 chapters that have these facets of artistic process that I think we all work with, even when it's not physical or time-based art.
Now, can you tell me the 12 points that you have? Why did you choose to make time like the first one, which I thought was very important, because everyone's like, I don't have time to do this. I don't have time to do that. So your book is showing people a different way to even look at time.
Time to me feels like the most personal. The nervous system functions predominantly around time. So all of our survival moments, I think, are time-based. The passage into birth, passage into death. When you watch animals at their most heightened state, they're either like stalking and elasticizing time and hesitating, or they're pouncing, thrusting, whatever it is. Like, I think time really tunes into the nervous system, which is our most personal response system to our lived experience. And even in writing, which you would say experientially is not time-based, meaning like you can sit there with a piece of writing and it doesn't necessarily move through time in a set duration. But of course, we know from reading, especially good writing, that time is absolutely saturated in writing. Rhythm saturates writing. And of course, you are reading it in durational time. So we talk about time-based arts, and that really means like things that are happening in real time, like dance and theater and music, where you're sitting in a theater and this thing is happening. But I think all of life and all of art is time-based. And the best art knows how to catalyze time to activate in the best way the receiver, the audience, or the reader, their nervous system. Because our nervous systems are tuned to experiencing time as a heightened experience. If everything is very even all the time, we have less emotional experience. It's the hesitation or the rushing, the condensing and the elasticizing of time and rhythm that gives us that emotional feeling. And that happens on the written page almost as much as it happens in like the verbal or physical exchange.
I want to switch gears a little bit and talk to you about performance poetry, with you having the theater and dance and background. How important is it, or beneficial is it, for a poet who has been writing all their life to maybe study acting or things like that, if they're looking into getting on that stage and performing that poem in front of an audience?
I think it depends on the person. I think that can be incredibly valuable. I have a friend who's a poet who she has to take an anti-anxiety medication before she does a reading. She gets so nervous to speak in public. And for her, dance really helped. And of course, not every poet wants to be performing their work. Some are, you know, perfectly happy sitting behind a book, and there's nothing wrong with that. I would say if it is a goal of a poet to be performing, then embodiment, grounding, this thing that we're talking about around rhythm, vocal dynamics, connecting with an audience, relating, feels crucial. And some people may just naturally have that, and their own work comes out of their body in a very organic way, and they feel fully alive and awake and fully themselves when they read their work, and they don't need any help with it, and that's wonderful. And then other people might feel less fluid and organic with that. And for somebody like that, I feel like the right kind of somatic or theater or dance training would be great. I don't think they're all created equal, and I don't think they'll all do the job. I don't necessarily think that taking a traditional ballet class is going to help you perform on stage, but getting comfortable in the body, getting fluent with rhythm, getting experience in this time-based gesture of relating and expressing, which means like in real time, immediate time, which is different from sitting at your notebook or your computer and writing, where you can get up and get a cup of coffee and come back and pick the right word and then think for a while. That's not time-based in the same way that performing is time-based, where you can't really take that break, right? You're condensing an experience. I mentioned this idea of like condensing to a poetic gesture. And so for something like that, I do think you need to have this resilience around immediacy and presence, and you need to be able to ground yourself, and you need to be able to feel your work in your body, because your body and performance is the conduit for your poetry, right? Like the written page is the conduit for your poetry outside of performance. But your body is the conduit for your work in performance. And if your body's not comfortable, then the relationship and the expression of your work will suffer, just the way if a book got ink splattered on it or got soaked in a rainstorm, that book is going to have deficits in how it communicates your work. And if your body is not functioning well, the way that book that got soaked by water is not functioning well, if your body's not functioning at a pretty high level for authenticity, then your work's not going to get communicated in the same way.
I love that analogy. Now, before I close the conversation, is there anything in the book that I did not ask about that you think is important for our listeners to know?
Well, I do think another universal thing, and I just like to thank you for trusting me to come on here, because it was a hope that I have in the book that it would speak to people in other art forms. I did niche down in my focus and perspective to dance and theater, but as I was writing it, I was really hopeful that other artists would be able to find value in it. So this feels like a little proof of concept, and I feel really grateful for that.
No problem.
One thing that's in there that I think is quite universal is your relationship to your inner critic. And one thing that I talk about in the book is that your inner critic is a part of you, and there's no part of you that's really trying to sabotage or take you down. All the parts of you are trying to survive. And your inner critic is trying to help you. It just has methods that aren't super functional or efficient and might even be detrimental. So I think sometimes we either get felled by our inner critic or we try to exile our inner critic, and neither one of them are really very holistic. So in the book, I talk about relating to your inner critic the way you might relate to your teenage child. And if your teenage child was talking to you in a way that was really hurtful to you. We could just lay down the law and say, you know, you're grounded, you can't talk to me like that, you know, get in your room, be quiet. Probably not going to generate a great relationship. We could fall into a puddle on the floor and just, I can't believe you said that to me, and nothing else transpires. Or we could say, okay, you clearly are having a lot of feeling and you clearly want me to know something. And I want to know what it is you want me to know. And I can't hear it when you talk to me like that. So I'm going to need to help you figure out a different way to express yourself. But I want you to know I want to hear what you have to say. And I think that's the tone with which we need to converse with our inner critic. And the other thing I think is important in this inner critic relationship is timing. And so same thing with the teenager. If I were in the middle of a writing project or a Zoom call and my teenage child knocked on my door, I would feel comfortable saying, I can't right now. I'll talk to you later. I'm in the middle of something. When we're in the middle of instinct, intuition, flow, wildness, playfulness, etc., that inner critic coming in and trying to ask for analysis or, proof or something like that, all it does is shut down the work we're doing. So I want to get into a way to relate to the inner critic where there's a tempo and a phrasing where I can say, I do want to talk to you, but I can't talk to you right now. And that they go away, you know, as hopefully your teenager, if they saw you on a Zoom call, would be like, sorry.
Oh, I love that. This conversation has been very therapeutic. And I am hoping that it's the same for other writers. Now, can you tell me, when is the book coming out? I know it's next year.
Yeah, June 25th is the expected delivery date. It's on Bloomsbury. I will have information about it on my website, which is alexandrabellerdances.org. And it'll be out June 25th in ebook and paperback and hardcover through Bloomsbury.
Now, how can people keep in contact with you or follow you?
That website has lots of goodies. It's got some free embodiment exercises, meditations, classes. It's got some excerpts from the book and plenty of ways to contact me through my website.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me and joining the Poetically Yours podcast.
Thank you so much, Yvonne.
Thank you once again for listening to the Poetically Yours Extended Podcast. Stay tuned for next month's. Former Rockford Poet Laureate Jenna Goldsmith will join us to talk about her upcoming book. Listen to Poetically Yours every Friday during Here and Now and All Things Considered on WNIJ. Listen anytime at WNIJ.org. Special thanks to the Nick Monte Trio Band for providing the music for this podcast. For Poetically Yours, I'm Yvonne Booz.